I want you to picture probably the most mundane action imaginable. You walk into a room, you flip a switch, the lights come on.
Yeah, it's instantaneous.
Right, it's instant. It's completely boring. We have this total expectation that power is just, well, that it's just there. But we really rarely stop to think about the sheer violence involved in that transaction.
Violence is actually the perfect word for it. I mean, right. we forget that the grid is essentially a contained explosion that we're just, you know, channeling through copper wires.
Exactly. And that is exactly where today's topic comes in. We are looking at the machinery that keeps all that violence in check. So today, we're doing a deep dive into electrical switchgear. And look, I know. Yeah, switchgear. It sounds like something you'd find in a dusty, I don't know, maintenance manual at the bottom of a tool chest. It sounds incredibly dry.
It definitely has a bit of an industrial branding problem, I'll admit that.
But looking at the stack of research we have today, we've got technical standards like IEC 62271, we've got the ANSI and IEC 37 series, OSHA regulations. This isn't just plumbing. This is the nervous system and the bodyguard of the entire modern world.
That's a really fair assessment. I mean, without switchgear, the grid is just a bomb waiting to go off. You're really the invisible backbone. You don't see it, but if it stops working, you don't just lose your lights. You lose manufacturing, data centers, hospitals.
Everything.
Yeah, the modern world essentially grinds to a halt.
So our mission today is to decode these metal boxes for you. We need to figure out what they actually do, why they are so critical, and why the technology inside them is currently going through this massive revolution. Let's start with a high-level definition. If I'm explaining this to someone who basically thinks electricity is magic, what are we actually looking at?
At the simplest level, switchgear is a collective term. It's not one single device. It's the combination of electrical disconnect switches, fuses, or circuit breakers used to switch, control, protect, and isolate electrical circuits.
So it's the whole package deal.
Right. It's the metal enclosure, the conductors inside, the breakers, the controls, and it scales, right? It ranges from the panel in your basement, though that's a very simple version, all the way up to something the size of a house at a transmission substation handling hundreds of thousands of volts.
Right, and in the reading, I kept seeing these three words grouped together. The triad of switchgear functions, protection, control, and isolation. And the sources basically say you can't really separate them.
You really can't. If you take any one of those away, the system becomes either completely useless or incredibly dangerous.
Let's break them down then. But I want to push back on the protection part first. You called it the bodyguard earlier. But isn't that just a fuse? Why is it so complex?
Well, a fuse is a very simple form of protection. It burns out and that's it. But switchgear has to be smarter than that. It has to detect abnormal conditions. Usually that means a short circuit or an overcurrent situation. Imagine a tree falls on a power line, or a massive motor just seizes up in a factory. Suddenly, you have massive amounts of current flowing where it absolutely shouldn't be.
And a ton of heat, I imagine.
Intense heat. If that current keeps flowing, cables melt, fires start, equipment literally explodes. The protection aspect means the switchgear has to detect that fault and cut the power. And we were talking about extreme speed here. In a medium voltage system, it needs to react and clear that fault in milliseconds.
But here's the nuance I found really interesting in the reports. It's not just about turning the power off, it's about what you turn off. The documents mention this concept of selective coordination. Why does that matter so much?
That's where the intelligence of the protection comes in. Think about it. You don't want to black out an entire city grid just because one transformer blew up on a random side street. You want to isolate only the faulty section.
So it's surgical.
Exactly, surgical. The switchgear closest to the problem should trip, while the upstream gear, the main feeder, just stays on so the rest of the building or city stays powered.
Okay, so that's protection, the bodyguard. What about control?
Protection is reactive. But control is proactive. You don't only flip the switch when things break or catch fire. Maybe you need to shed load because the grid is stressed on a really hot summer day. Or maybe you need to reroute power to do routine maintenance. Switchgear gives operators the ability to manage the flow of energy. It's the traffic cop.
Which leads to the third function, and looking at the OSHA regulations, specifically 29 CFR 1910.147 for lockout tagout, this seems to be the one that literally keeps people alive. Isolation.
This one is absolutely non-negotiable. Isolation is about creating a verified gap in the circuit so humans can actually work on the equipment safely. And there's a key phrase of the standards here, which is visible break.
A visible break. Okay, let me play devil's advocate here for a second. Why do I need to actually see it? Can't I just look at the computer screen in the control room that says the power is off?
Absolutely not. In high-stakes industrial settings, sensors can fail. A mechanical limit switch can get stuck. A light bulb on a panel can burn out. You never, ever trust a sensor with your life.
So the standard requires eyes on the physical hardware.
Yes. In many switchgear designs, there is a physical viewing window or maybe a mechanical linkage where a technician can visually verify and say, okay, the copper contacts are physically separated. There is actual air between those two points. Electricity cannot jump that gap.
That is a seriously sobering thought. You need to literally see the air gap to know you aren't going to die to death.
Exactly. The golden rule is if you can't see the break, you assume the line is live.
I want to clear up a vocabulary point that tripped me up initially when I was reading through this. We have switchgear and we have circuit breakers. People tend to use them interchangeably, but they really aren't the same thing, are they?
It is a super common mistake. Think of it like this. The circuit breaker is just one component. It's the muscle that actually snaps open to stop the current. Switchgear is the entire system. It's the metal housing, the bus bars, which are those thick strips of copper or aluminum that carry the power, the controls, the safety interlocks, and the breaker all combined.
Oh, so the breaker sits inside the switchgear.
Precisely. You can buy a circuit breaker on its own, but it needs the switchgear assembly around it to actually function safely in the grid.
Got it. Now, let's talk about the voltage classes quickly, because the IEC 60388 standard breaks this down into a hierarchy.
Right. The voltage classes dictate how big and how robust the gear needs to be.
So we have low voltage, or LV, which is up to 1 kV. That's your buildings and factors. Then medium voltage, MV, from 1 kV to 36 kV for distribution. And then high voltage, HV, which is 36 kV, up to 245 kV for the massive transmission lines.
That's the breakdown. And dealing with those higher voltages brings us to the physics of stopping the power. Because stopping high voltage electricity isn't like just turning off a faucet at your sink. If you pull two live wires apart under load, the electricity doesn't just politely stop, does it?
No, it jumps.
It desperately wants to keep flowing. So as you pull the metal contacts apart, the air between them ionizes and literally turns into plasma. You get an electrical arc.
Like lightning.
Exactly like lightning.
Yeah.
And that arc is incredibly hot and highly conductive. If you don't extinguish it fast, the current just keeps flowing right through the air and the switch completely melts down.
So how do we kill the arc? Because the sources talk about different insulation types, like air-insulated switchgear versus gas-insulated switchgear, AIS versus GIS.
Right. For a long time, we just used air. AIS. You just pull the contacts far enough apart that the arc stretches out and eventually breaks. But air isn't a very efficient insulator, so you need a massive amount of physical space to stretch that arc.
Which explains why older utility substations take up entire fields of metal structures.
Yes. But what happens if you need to put a power substation in the basement of a skyscraper in Manhattan? You simply don't have that kind of space. Enter gas-insulated switchgear, or GIS.
And this is where we meet what the industry considered the miracle gas. Sulfur hexafluoride, SF6.
SF6 really was an electrical engineer's dream. It is extremely electronegative.
Meaning what, exactly?
It means the gas molecules absolutely love to gobble up free electrons. An electrical arc is essentially just a stream of excited electrons. So when the arc tries to form, the SF6 gas essentially eats the energy, quenching the arc much, much faster than an air ever could. Because of that, you can pack the equipment incredibly tightly. A GIS system using SF6 can be 10% the size of an air-insulated version.
10%? That is a massive difference when you're talking about real estate costs in a city.
It's game-changing. It allowed us to build high-voltage grids inside dense modern cities. But there is a very serious catch.
The environmental catch. And reading this part, the trade-off gets pretty painful.
It is a massive problem today. SF6 is actually the most potent greenhouse gas known to man. It has a global warming potential, a GWP of 23,500.
Let's put that in context for you listening. CO2, carbon dioxide, has a GWP of 1.
Correct. So 1 single pound of SF6 leaked into the atmosphere is the equivalent of releasing 23,500 pounds of CO2. And it just sits there in the atmosphere for thousands of years.
So the industry has been relying on a gas that is basically a climate bomb just because it saves physical space. I mean, that seems incredibly short-sighted now, doesn't it?
In hindsight, sure. But for decades, it was truly the only technical way to meet the exploding demand for urban power. It was viewed as a necessary evil. reliability and compactness versus the environment. But that entire paradigm is changing now, which we'll definitely get to.
Let's hold on the environmental shift for a second, because before we look at the future of that gas, I want to talk about the business of reliability. Switchgear isn't just about safety or saving space, it's about raw economics. I saw a stat from a Deloitte report here saying unplanned shutdowns cost U.S. manufacturing over $50 billion annually.
It's a staggering number. And it's not just the lights going out. If you are a semiconductor manufacturer or a pharmaceutical plant, a power blink of just 20 milliseconds can ruin an entire batch of product worth millions of dollars.
So reliability is literally a product feature of the switchgear itself. This is where those utility acronyms, PACE, IED, and ACIFI come in, right?
Right. Those are essentially the report cards for power utilities. SAIT stands for System Average Interruption Duration Index. Basically, how many minutes per year was the average customer sitting in the dark? And SAIFI is System Average Interruption Frequency Index. How many times did the power actually go out?
So if a utility buys cheap or unreliable switchgear, their SAID and SAIFI numbers look terrible.
Exactly. And regulators look at those numbers and will often hit utilities with massive fines if they get too high.
There's a specific technology mentioned in modern switchgear designed to improve this. It's called ZSI, or Zone Selective Interlocking. Now, I have to say, the description in the technical manual was pretty dense. Can you explain how this actually works without getting too bogged down in the wiring diagrams?
I can try. Remember earlier we talked about selective coordination, where we want only the breaker closest to the fault to trip.
Right, the surgical strike.
Well, historically, that relied on simple timing. In a dumb system, the main upstream breaker just waits a set amount of time, say half a second, to see if the little downstream breaker handles the problem first.
So the main breaker is just being patient.
Yes. But that half a second of waiting is a half second where a massive destructive fault current is literally frying your downstream equipment. It causes physical damage. It's incredibly stressful on the entire system.
So how does ZSI fix the waiting game?
ZSI connects the breakers with a digital communication line. They actually talk to each other.
What are they saying?
It's a digital handshake.
Yeah.
If a downstream breaker sees a fault, it instantly sends a signal up to the main breaker saying, I see the fault, it's in my zone, I'm handling it, hold your fire.
And if the upstream breaker doesn't get that signal?
Then it trips instantly. It assumes the fault is right there at the main bus bar, where no other smaller breaker can possibly help. So ZSI gives you the absolute best of both worlds. You get the isolation to keep the rest of the plant running, and you get the speed to protect the equipment. It drastically reduces fire and damage because you aren't waiting around for that extra half second.
Speaking of damage, we really need to talk about the most terrifying concept in this entire stack of documents, the arc flash.
Yes. This is the absolute nightmare scenario for anyone in the industry.
I think most people imagine an arc flash as just a big spark, like static electricity from a doorknob, but maybe a bit bigger.
No, that is a very dangerous misconception. An arc flash is a literal explosion. If the insulation fails, or much more commonly, if a technician accidentally drops a metal wrench across two live bus bars, the air instantly short circuits. You get an expanding ball of plasma. The temperatures inside that plasma can reach 35,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
That is hotter than the surface of the sun.
Four times hotter than the sun. But here is the physics reality that really gets you. When solid copper turns into vapor at that temperature, it expands 67,000 times in volume.
It's 67,000.
Instantly. All right. That massive expansion creates a supersonic pressure wave, a literal bomb blast that can blow the heavy steel doors right off the switchgear and throw a worker across the room. It's a concussive force combined with a wave of molten metal shrapnel.
That is terrifying. And this is why standards like IE 1584 exist, right? To calculate what they call the incident energy.
Right. Engineers have to calculate exactly how much explosive energy would be released at a specific working distance, usually where the technician's chest or face would be standing. That complex math tells you exactly what kind of protective spacesuit, the Arc Flash PPE, you legally need to wear under NFPA 70E. It's a fundamental duty of care.
But the gear itself is changing to handle this too, not just the suits. I was reading about arc-resistant switchgear. How does that actually help? Because if the copper vaporizes inside the box, the explosion is still happening. How does making it resistant help the person standing there?
It doesn't stop the explosion from happening. It controls the direction of the blast. Standard gear might just blow the front doors open right into the face of the operator. Arc-resistant gear is heavily reinforced and sealed completely tight at the front. It has special exhaust vents called plenums built onto the top.
Like a chimney system.
Exactly like a chimney, When the blast happens, pressure flaps open on the roof of the gear and channel the pressure, the fire, and the toxic copper gas up and completely out of the building.
So the equipment itself is completely sacrificed, but the person standing in front of it survives.
That's the entire design philosophy.
Right.
Preserve human life at the cost of the metal box. There's also a newer feature called maintenance mode that helps with this.
What does that do?
It's a physical switch or a software setting that a worker activates right before they walk into the electrical room. It tells the protection relays to become hair trigger sensitive. It temporarily removes all those intentional time delays we talked about, like the half-second wait.
So if anything goes wrong, if a fault happens, it trips immediately.
Faster than immediate. It minimizes the total time the arc is allowed to burn, which drastically reduces the amount of explosive energy released into the room.
But wait, if it's that hair trigger sensitive, doesn't that mean the power to the facility might go out accidentally, like a nuisance trip?
Yes, it might. You are intentionally trading reliability for safety while the human being is in the blast zone. You accept the financial risk that the factory lights might flicker just to ensure the operator goes home to their family that night.
That definitely seems like a trade-off worth making every time. Let's pivot to the future now. We've thoroughly established that this is critical, dangerous, and very expensive equipment. But reading these reports, it seems like the era of the dumb metal box is officially over. We are moving toward what they call the digital substation.
We are essentially replacing tons of copper with light.
Explain that shift.
Traditionally, to control a substation, you had thousands of physical copper wires running from the switchgear out in the yard all the way back to the control room. Each individual wire carried one very simple analog signal. Breaker is open. Breaker is closed.
That sounds like a massive amount of copper.
Literal tons of it. It's expensive and hard to maintain. Now, using a digital standard called IEC 61850, we are replacing those massive bundles of copper with fiber optic Ethernet cables.
So the switchgear is essentially just a node on the IT network now.
It's fully digitized. Instead of electromechanical relays, we use numerical IEDs, intelligent electronic devices. It allows for incredibly dense real-time analytics. You can monitor the mechanical health of the breaker, the physical temperature of the contacts, the exact quality of the power wave, all remotely from a laptop. And obviously, it saves the massive labor and material cost pulling all that traditional copper wire.
But the biggest shift in the future section seems to be environmental. We have to go back to the SF6 gas issue. With the new EU regulation 2025-573, there is a strict legal mandate to start phasing it out in new equipment. If SF6 is the miracle gas, what actually replaces it? Is there anything else that's as good?
This is the billion-dollar race in the industry right now. For lower medium voltages, we are seeing a big push toward clean dry air or just pure vacuum technology, and that works really well. But for high voltage transmission, it's much harder to replace.
Because air just needs way too much physical space to stop a 200,000 volt arc.
Right. So chemical companies are developing complex alternative mixtures. You'll see things like fluorinitrile, something called G3 gas in the industry. These new chemical cocktails have excellent insulation properties, almost matching SF6. But they have a global warming potential that is 99% lower.
So we are finally decoupling the physical grid infrastructure from that massive greenhouse gas footprint.
We have to. It's hypocritical otherwise. You can't claim to have a green grid powered by clean wind and solar if the substations themselves are constantly leaking a super pollutant into the atmosphere.
Speaking of wind and solar, I honestly didn't realize how much these renewable sources complicate the life of a piece of switchgear. There's a specific term in the sources islanding. It sounds somewhat tropical and nice, but the context in the safety manual was incredibly scary.
It is genuinely scary. This is a major, major safety challenge with what we call distributed energy resources, or DERs.
How does an island actually happen?
Imagine a severe storm knocks out the main utility power line feeding a neighborhood. As far as the utility is concerned, the grid is dead. But your neighborhood happens to have 50 houses with solar panels on the roofs.
And the sun comes out after the storm.
Right. So those panels are still actively generating power. If the local system isn't smart, that power flows backwards out of the residential houses and right onto the main utility power line.
The exact line that the utility worker is driving up to fix, thinking it is completely dead?
Exactly. They get out of the bucket truck to fix the downed line, assuming it's safe because the main substation switchgear is open. But the line is actually live, because of the residential solar panels secretly backfeeding the system. That energized pocket is an island.
That's a literal death trap for the line worker.
It is. So modern switchgear and the local solar inverters need to be smart enough to detect that the main grid frequency is gone and immediately automatically disconnect the solar panels from the street. It's a complex layer of digital intelligence we simply didn't need 20 years ago, when power only flowed in one predictable direction, from the big coal plant down to your house.
It's fascinating. We started this deep dive thinking about a completely boring metal box, but it turns out to be this crazy intersection of high energy physics, digital logic, international environmental policy, and literal life or death safety protocols.
It really is the unsung hero of the modern age. It quietly facilitates literally everything we do.
So, just to recap everything for you listening, switchgear is the triad of protection, control, and isolation. It's currently moving away from dangerous SF6 gas to green chemical alternatives, and it's evolving from dumb copper wires to intelligent fiber optics.
And at the end of the day, it's the only reason human beings can safely coexist with the massive high voltages required to run human civilization.
I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on today. We spend so much time in the media talking about the green transition in terms of generation, you know, building more wind turbines, installing more solar panels on roofs. But reading through these technical standards, it becomes abundantly clear that generating the power is actually the easy part.
The really hard part is managing the power safely.
Exactly. Without the quiet evolution of switchgear, without solving that massive SF6 climate problem and figuring out how to handle the complex two-way power flows of a digital grid, the clean energy revolution technically cannot happen. That boring gray metal box sitting behind a chain link fence is actually the ultimate gatekeeper to our green future.
I couldn't agree more with that.
That's it for today's deep dive. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.